time, is inept and dissolute. The king can't control his own wife. He tells her to come. He, in typical overkill for the Book of Esther, he sends seven eunuchs to go get her. Seven guys to go get one woman. Why? Well, it's just we're intended to see him as someone who overdoes everything if he does anything at all. But he can't control his own wife. His wife then refuses to come, making him look like an idiot, which he already was, but now everybody knows it. And so he doesn't know what to do, and he calls all his counselors together and says, "Guys, I can't control my wife. What am I supposed to do about this?" Notice, though, in the text that he doesn't phrase it in that way. How does he phrase the problem in verse 15 of chapter 1? Right, it's a legal problem, not a personal problem. It's a legal problem. That's like the only clever thing Ahasuerus does in the entire book, is managing to phrase his own marital problems as legal problems. Everything else he does is just totally inept. So he can't make decisions on his own. He has to get advice about how to, you know, handle his own wife's disobedience. The only thing he can manage to do by himself is to micromanage people's behavior. The decree in verse 8 about drinking, which is a little bit difficult to translate, but no matter how you translate it, it basically means that the king made a rule that there was no rule about drinking. Maybe it means you can drink as much as you want, maybe it means you don't have to drink anything. Not really clear from the text, but whatever it is, the king has made a law that says there is no law. Why does he feel the need to make that kind of a law? Except that maybe he just knows that that's what kings do. They make laws, and oh, here's a law I thought of. Let's make that. You know, I mean, we're intended to see that he's micromanaging here. He's going to do it again later. The only other law he makes without any input from anyone else is the law that everyone has to bow down to his grand vizier, who they were supposed to bow down to anyway. We'll talk about what that means when we get there, but again, micromanaging. He only is kind of making laws himself about tiny little insignificant things that shouldn't really matter.
So he keeps projecting himself as like the one in control,
Idea. Yeah, and that's typical of, if you've had a boss or a supervisor who kind of micromanages, often that's the reason. That's the way they know to assert their authority and show that they're the most important person in the room, is by making these making these laws. Everyone has to be here 7.5 minutes early for their shift, you know, and if you're 7 minutes early, you're late. You're just trying to show us who's the boss. But on top of that, I mean, I think the other thing we're supposed to see in verse 15 is that the king doesn't actually know the law. There's probably not a law about this situation, but what he's asking for is, what are the precedents that we would make a decision based on? But he doesn't even know that. He has to ask his counselors, what does the law say about this? And the other thing is, Esther is full of ironies and reversals, and this is one of them. The king says, "Go get Vashti and tell her to come in here." Vashti says, "I don't want to go in there." And so the king says, "Fine, you can't come in here." Like, he lost. When we're supposed to see that, I think he is sanctioning her disobedience by banishing her, by saying, "You can't come into my presence again." Now, that's not to say that banishing her would have been the most pleasant thing for her. It's just we're intended to see Ahasuerus as a buffoon. He's drunk. I forgot about that. This drinking thing shows up over and over again in Esther. Apparently the Persians, that was their custom. They would make laws and decisions while they were drunk. They would get drunk to make decisions, have somebody who presumably wasn't drunk, he's like the designated writer, write down the law, and then in the morning when they were sober again, they'd review it and see if it still made sense. Right? So this is totally typical of the Persian Empire, to make decisions and to make laws like this one about, you know, every man is the ruler of his house, while they were drunk. But in making that law, notice that he's broadcasting to the whole world that he can't control his wife. Right? And what's ironic about that is the reason they made the law in the first place is that they were afraid people would hear about what Vashti had done and imitate her. Women would imitate her, and men would be dishonored by their wives. And so they make a law saying, don't do what the king did. Don't make, you know, don't embarrass yourselves like he did. Be the ruler in your own house, which the king can't do. So we're intended to see Ahasuerus and his court as a little bit buffoonish and inept. I have an observation to make about this kind of leadership vacuum that we see demonstrated in the Persian Empire in this text. But before I do that, is there anything else that you see in chapter 1 that you want to bring out? We're gonna cycle back to why this is even in here, but anything that jumps out at you, questions you have, things you've heard about the text?
I read up a bit on kind of the extra text that the Jewish people have, like they would study in addition to this. One of the interesting theories they had in there was that Vashti is somehow the descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. I'm not sure how factual that was, but like when the Persians came in and took over, they killed everyone except Vashti and had her married off to Ahasuerus or Xerxes, however it's written. So what I'm thinking is kind of frustrating for her seeing what's technically her kingdom, more people ruled over by this buffoonish guy who sounds like she doesn't respect her somewhat valid reasons. She's drunk, she can't do anything. And also, while all this is going on, she's also hosting her own party for like the women and the spouses of all these people. So she's kind of doing her own thing. He's like, hey, dress up, or in some text, just come out in just your crown, come out and parade yourself in front of all my also equally drunk council members. She's like, no, kind of don't want to do that.
Right.
But like, also the main thing about Vashti, in the grand scheme of things, she's not an extremely important character. Her purpose is that she was there as the queen, and then she had to be sent away because God's main purpose was to put Esther there in that place so that she could be there to save God's people.
So, I think you're reading some things into the text, some of which we'll address a little bit later. But one thing I would say is I think Vashti's story is more important than just that, and we'll talk about why that is. As far as that's a fairly common interpretation that when it says to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people, there is this very early interpretation that the implication was that she was to appear only in her crown. That's not in the text. Right? That's one of the things that, remember last time we talked about, what does the text require? I'm not sure the text requires that, because whether that's what the king intended or not, the purpose is the same. He's bringing her out so that they can stare at her. And whether it's to display her beauty by her not having any clothes on, or his wealth by all the jewelry that she's wearing, it's the same point, right? He is making her an object of his a demonstration of his power and splendor and wealth. But that's what we talked about last time, that you don't need her to appear in only her crown in order for the text to make that point. And so that's a very good example of this kind of attempt that we are making to read the text for what it says and not for anything else. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a very common way of understanding this text. And this issue of men and women in the Book of Esther is one that I want to talk about. In the story, of course, Esther is going to gain power. She's going to end up making laws in the king's name. And I just think it's worth pointing out at this point that in Scripture, when godly women take positional leadership, and I've got some examples here, but when they do that, it is almost inevitably when the men are failing to do that. It isn't when the godly women do it, so we're accepting, you know, Athaliah and people like that, but when the godly women do it, it's because the men are not. And I think that's an important point for all of us to understand. The one that I really want to point out, because it makes this point very strongly, is Deborah in jail. In Judges,
when you read that text has a strong message about gender roles. That who's responsible for what in God's plan. And the most significant part of the text from that perspective is when Jael kills Sisera, he says to her, if anyone comes and asks you, is anyone in the tent, tell them no one's here. What he actually says literally is, if anyone asks, is there any man in the tent, tell them no. So he is, in effect, emasculating himself in the conversation with her, and then she's the one who kills him, right? And again, we're intended to see that when there's no godly male leadership, the godly women are the ones who are then thrust into that responsibility, which is not God's plan. And so Esther is another good example of that kind of gender reversal. Because the king and the kingdom are so corrupt and dissolute, you end up having to you end up being ruled by a teenage Jewish girl, you know. And it glorifies God that he can work in that way, but that's not the way that God intends things to work. And I think we are intended to see those ideas about gender at play in this text. So let's talk about why Vashti's story is in the text. I think this chapter demonstrates the king's lack of character. I've probably made that abundantly clear by now. He's not an admirable person in any way. But this is the person that Esther and Mordecai have to work with and around and through in order to save their people. So we're setting the stage for what will happen later by characterizing Ahasuerus in this way. And so we're setting the stage in that way. Also, it sets up the ironic reversal of the king being ruled by both of his wives who are named in the story. He can't overcome Vashti's refusal to come to him. He has no way of answering that. So he makes a law that every man should be the master in his own household, which Esther then breaks by telling him what to do. And she will come to him unbidden. Again, there's these reversals, these back and forth. Vashti refuses to come when she's summoned. Esther goes in when she isn't summoned. You see that reversal in the text. But Esther's going to dictate laws in the king's name, and she's going to give him instructions, we'll see, on how to, not just on the laws he should make, but actually how to govern his kingdom. And we are intended to see that reversal. And if you don't have Vashti's story, that reversal doesn't mean anything. It just sounds like Esther got an idea and managed to push it through into legislation. Vashti's story shows us that this is in keeping with the pattern of the way Ahasuerus operates, and it's a part of God's plan. Also, as we'll examine later, Vashti's story is actually pretty integral to our understanding of God's providence as it is demonstrated in the book of Esther. So,
add just one little detail to that, not just dictate laws, but it's unalterable law in Persia.
Right.
Which is very ironic.
Right.
It's a law that cannot be altered.
It's unalterable, but it's not unbreakable.
Your husbands.
Right. Yeah, you can't alter it, but you can break it. Exactly. And then this chapter also builds tension for chapter 5 because we have Ahasuerus characterized as someone who does not have a history of putting up with presumptuous wives no matter how pretty they are. Right? That's what's at stake when Esther decides to go into the throne. Without chapter 1, the stakes feel lower. And so I think this chapter is important for the drama of the book and for our understanding of the characters who are in it. Anything else on chapter 1 that you'd like to discuss or to talk about? Okay, so in chapter 2, we're now a few years down the road, and the king has gone to battle, been defeated, comes home, and decides he needs to replace Vashti. And because of who he is, I like the way verses 1 and 2 of chapter 2 say this. After these things, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants, so these are not his counselors, they're his servants. say, let beautiful young virgins be brought for the king. So he's so inept, his servants can dictate to him, right? And their solution is, you gotta go find yourself a new wife. So again, he calls his counselors to fix his problems for him. That is implied when they talk about let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom. These are the bureaucracy that's going to be in charge of this this year-long sex contest. And they're so what they go and round up young women and bring them in. And just for some context, stories like this rightly give feminists fits, because look at the objectification of women and, you know, the way the king is treating them, rounding them up without their consent, all that kind of thing. And that's definitely true. Don't want to minimize that. I would just point out he also did it to men. And he would round them up when they were boys every year, usually, just about every year, we can tell. He'd round up young women and young men. He'd put the young women in the harem, and he'd turn the young men into eunuchs and make them servants in the palace. Again, that's not to diminish the suffering and the consequences for either group. It's just to say that this characteristic, this cruelty and inhumanity of the Persian Empire is completely characteristic. What we have in the book is a very accurate representation of the ways that the Persians would behave. But the other thing that's significant about that custom is that the king doesn't even have enough imagination to think, well, that's what we always do, why don't we just do it again? Right? It's like he's so inept, they have to remind him of the thing he always does. Am I doing a good enough job of painting this guy as an idiot? Because he is, and we're intended to see that. Again, this characterization of the king as needing lots of help and not really being able to make decisions on his own continues into chapter 2. And then if we fast forward in the chapter a little bit, when a new queen is chosen, because they're virgins, it's time to party again. And so the king makes it a holiday. This is in verse 17 to 18. That 18, the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty, which probably means that he gave everybody a break on paying taxes for a period of time. And that's significant. We'll come back to that when we get into chapter 3 about the significance of canceling taxes. But he makes a holiday, he gives gifts, has a feast, and of course you can't have a feast without drinking. So again, this characterization continues. So in the context of this roundup, we meet Esther and Mordecai. So Mordecai is a descendant, verse 5 tells us, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, who else do you know who is a descendant of Kish, the Benjamite? Yeah, King Saul was a descendant of Kish, right? So, there's some chronological issues around Mordecai's lineage here, which I'm not going to go into. If you're interested, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. But the point is, we are intended to see Mordecai as another descendant of Kish, another Saul. And we'll explore the significance of that as we go through the text. But it's important that Mordecai is introduced that way. Remember, we talked last time about how you are who your father is? This is an example of that. And we'll see how this idea of Mordecai being another Saul develops as we go through the story. But Mordecai has chosen not to return to Israel after the decree of Cyrus. We don't know why. One interesting theory that may hold some weight, given some other things in the text, is that Mordecai was one of those boys who'd been rounded up when he was young and made a eunuch, and therefore he would not be allowed to enter into the temple precincts in Jerusalem, and so he would think, well, I'm just going to stay here. There's no point, you know. That's all speculation, but it does fit with some elements in the text. But anyway, he's raising Esther, who is his cousin. It's his uncle's daughter, is the best reading of the text. We sometimes call her his niece. They wouldn't have kind of delineated it that carefully, but probably she's his cousin. And she's because she's beautiful and there, she's rounded up and taken to the palace with the rest of the girls. But Mordecai tells her not to reveal her nationality to her or her family, which is important because that means she's not supposed to tell people that she's related to him. And I think that's because people know him, and they know he's a Jew. We'll come back to that in just a minute. But he tells her not only not to tell them that she's Jewish, but not to tell them that she's related to him, not to tell them who her family is. And again, we talked a little bit about kind of what Esther is losing when she goes into the king's harem, but she's losing her identity by not being able to tell them who she is and who her family is. In this world, that was her identity. And she's been told by her own family member not to tell anybody. Okay. So that had to be hard. That had to be a difficult thing for her to deal with. So what jumps out at you so far in this chapter? We're down about through verse 11, although we skipped ahead to the end a little bit.
I'm wondering if she was the only Jewish girl taken in. If she's like, surely there had to have been at least a couple other Jewish women who were also taken into the harem, but they might not necessarily have known each other. It's like, there's enough Jewish people left in Persia at this point that later him killing all of them, that would have been a lot of people killed. So it's just like, where was everyone else?
Yeah, I don't know. The people in the gate seem to know, and the king later knows, because in the treaty, they seem to know that Mordecai is a Jew. So it could just be that everybody else knew, except the officials who mattered, because they were the ones who would have told the king if they had known. But here's another question. Why does it matter at this point in the story if she's Jewish? Right? It doesn't. I can't make any reason make sense that it would matter at this point in the story that she's Jewish. Now, there may be some cultural things going on. We would say racist things going on. There could be some of those. But given where Mordecai is up at the end of the story, I'm not so sure that that's a valid reading of the text. Right? Yes?
I think maybe it could be in there just so the reader knows, hey, Esther is a Jew, and like when the Jews read the story, they almost know right off the bat, this is the good person.
Yes, and that's why she's identified, and Mordecai as well, as being Jewish, and why Mordecai's ancestors are listed. But why does he tell her not to tell anybody else? You see that? Yes.
Well, the only thing I would think that there's very, very, very few instances in history where the conquered people ever end up being in the same social class as the conquered people. And so it could just be something to that effect of, even if it's not racist, it just may just be like, oh, you know, I don't want to go down to that level. You know?
So that's less true in this period of history. So remember that Daniel and his friends, by the time they end their careers, they're like the top level of official in the kingdom. And they were first generation immigrants, if you want to think of them that way, right? And the Persian Empire inherited a lot of the Babylonian Empire's government systems. So it's possible, but given the evidence, I think it's just weird. I think it's just... What I actually think is happening is Mordecai and Esther at this point in the story are afraid. And like most, you know, like some fears, this fear may be irrational. It may not be founded in any facts. It may just be they're afraid. Of what? I don't know. Of being found out. Of something. The worst interpretation would be they're ashamed to be God's people because of what that would require of them in terms of behavior. Which, given what happens next in the story, is a likely scenario.
Notice that in this chapter, Esther is totally passive. She doesn't do anything in the entire chapter. Everything is done to her. She's rounded up. She's taken in. She's promoted. She's sent into the king. She finds favor in his sight. She doesn't even gain his approval. It's kind of bestowed upon her, you know. She pleased Haggai, the eunuch, and found favor with him. What criteria do you think he's using, given what Vashti had done? Yeah, she's pretty and will not say anything, will not disobey, will not get out of line. That's more than likely what he's looking for. And she pleased him. She does nothing in the text to compromise herself, including revealing her background, whatever extent she was afraid that would compromise her. And as a result, she's advanced to the best place in the harem. But again, she doesn't do anything. That's the point. She just sits there and is promoted because she sits there, because she has this, at least, appearance of not being one to assert herself. Again, that's evidenced in verse 15 when she goes into Ahasuerus. She does not request anything except what Haggai advised. There are lots of ways to read that. Some are more sort of explicit than others. I think the point is just that she's being totally passive. She just, I don't know, whatever you think is best. Hey, guy. That's what she takes with her. So the king wants to replace Vashti with someone that he can control, and Esther's passivity makes her the perfect candidate in Haggai's eyes. So that's one side of Esther's behavior in this chapter, which is not great. The other side of her behavior, unfortunately, is even worse, because we're intended in various, there are various kind of linguistic and situational parallels between this story in Esther and the story of Daniel and his friends in Daniel chapter, specifically in chapter 1, but in chapter 3 as well. Daniel and his friends very quickly say, look, we're Jews, we can't eat that. Esther hides her identity, and she eats what they give her. The eating is specifically mentioned in the text. Why? I think it's a contrast with Daniel chapter 1. She disobeys God to save her life. And let's not be coy about that. That's what she's doing. There are lots of attempts to kind of defend Esther's virtue. So you may have read or heard explanations like, well, when you would sleep with the king, you would become his wife, so that makes it okay. The sources we have suggest that the marriage was afterwards, that there was this contest to see who could please the king best sexually, and then afterwards the winner would marry the king, more like a modern game show than a traditional marriage. And there are other attempts to sort of sanitize the events by calling it a beauty pageant. You maybe heard that this contest referred to in that way. One writer, unfortunately, because it talks about the year they spent with cosmetics, calls it the biggest Mary Kay makeover party ever, which is just not what's going on. Because to win this contest, Esther has to be both the most passive and the most sexually satisfying woman in the land. No small task, but that's what's required in order for her to win. And even if the king is married to her when they sleep together by virtue of that act, he's already married. So she's breaking the laws about adultery. If they're not married, then it's fornication. And in any case, she is sleeping with and or marrying a pagan, all of which were against God's laws. And so I'm sorry if I have destroyed your view of Esther as this morally upright person. It might help if I say that she becomes that. And I think that's what we're supposed to see in the story of Esther. It's not just God working, but God changing his people, people who are willing to obey and follow him in the course of the text. But it raises this question, right? Did Esther have a choice? Or is she not accountable for anything that happened to her because, after all, it was forced upon her. It was done without her consent, to use kind of modern terminology. So what do you think? Did she have a choice?
Yes. Yep.
It's the same choice that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
It is. And it's the same choice that who else in the book of Esther has already made?
Vashti.
Vashti has already made the choice. You can disobey the king. Now, consequences may not be good, but if a pagan woman can do it, why can't a woman who is supposed to be one of God's people do it? Yes?
This one, how do we know that she ate something that was wrong? I mean, he liked her from the start.
The eunuch liked her.
Right.
The king wouldn't have met her until about a year later.
He liked her from the start. He gave her... How do you know she didn't request the food? I mean, Daniel's already taken place. They've already seen what happens when people eat the right foods.
Yeah.
So how do we know she didn't eat the right foods?
How do you know she did?
I don't know either. But
yeah, that's right. And so, and that's the
either way.
Yeah, that's the point that we made last time. Is that what does the text require? And one of the things I think the text does require is that we compare her behavior with the behavior of Daniel and his friends. And given that in the story of Daniel, the food is a specific issue, and given that the food is specifically mentioned here, I think we are invited to make that comparison. Otherwise, you have to answer the question, why does it mention the food? Like, she's not there to eat, right? She's not even there to be provided for. She's there to serve the king. You see what I'm saying?
I just don't necessarily agree with you.
So, well,
you know, I don't see it that way.
Okay. Yeah. But even if she doesn't break that law, there are all the other laws that she broke that we still have to find a way to countenance. Yes.
And Esther, who was killed or was pushed out onto the streets against she refused to do any of that, could not have been the Esther who led the direct state of the entire Jewish people from the death king letting someone massacre them.
Yes, that's true. Although, as Mordecai says, if you don't do this, salvation will arise to the Jews from somewhere else. Yes?
Okay, so the 2 points is that I think about the food. I think the difference with Daniel is he got that because he made his Jewish known, and it was known. And I think her just ambiguity about it kind of puts a lot more in that court that she probably did. And I think also the second point is, well, that, you know, choices are, you can only really see whether, you know, when you're in the middle of making that decision, it's really hard.
Yeah,
you
oh, yeah.
You really tell, you know, your life is on the line, you know?
Yep.
And I know that, you know, we sitting, you know, 2,000 years later are like, oh, you know, this is not the case. But, you know, when it comes to us and our lives on the line, you know, a lot of things change really fast.
Yeah.
I think that...
And I'll just say that, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do think that's why Vashti's story is so significant, is because we're not just looking back and, you know, from our armchairs and going, well, she should have done that. She actually has an example of someone who did that. So, you know, but anyway, sorry, continue.
I was going to say about choices, I think at every juncture you always have choices, but I think maybe the point more so is God can work through your bad decision.
Yes.
So even if she did say no and died, I mean, it's God. He could have resurrected
right.
her if he wanted to. You
That's
know,
right.
It doesn't matter. Like, God would still come through in the end anyway.
And ultimately, that's the point of the story. The point of the story is not about whether Esther did the right thing or the wrong thing here. I think it's clear that in some ways, at least, she did the wrong thing. Whether circumstantially that was acceptable or not is a slippery slope to start down. But that's not the point of the story. The point of the story, as Michaela is saying, is God's ability to use whatever choices we make to accomplish His purposes. And we shouldn't see that as license to do whatever we want and disobey God, but we should take comfort that when we do make poor choices, when we do give in to the circumstances around us, it doesn't stop God. And I think that's important. Yes?
I think like, since you made the point about comparing this with Daniel, I kind of went back, and one of the first things I've noticed is that with you saying Esther being very passive, it's almost like her decisions are being made right then and right there, almost a reactionary thing.
Or maybe another way of saying the same thing would be that her decision about the food, if that's an issue, and about, you know, pleasing the king and all that, has already been made for her by Mordecai.
Right.
Because what would be the basis for her refusing to do all these things? Well, it's because I'm Jewish. But she can't say that because Mordecai has told her not to. Right? So Mordecai doesn't come out of this looking real great either. Whatever his reasons might have been. I'm sorry.
The point I was going with was taking Esther, making more or less rash-ish decisions, and looking at Daniel, where it says Daniel had already purposed in his mind that he was going to follow God. And I think that's a lesson for us to take from it, saying that whatever situations we find ourselves in, because we will all be found in situations where we're going to have to make a choice. And if you are already purposed in your mind what you're going to do, you will hopefully you'll make the right decision.
Right. Yeah, the time to make those decisions is when you're sitting comfortably in your armchair, not facing. You know what I mean? Like, that's when you make those decisions so that you can live them in the moment. Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you know how much Esther knew, like, what she knew growing up and how much she had been in and around,
the Jewish culture?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know. But there are hints. She asks Mordecai to fast, which in the context of the Old Testament is always associated with prayer. We'll talk about this more later. How does she know to do that? It also, and this is significant to our understanding what's going on in the story, that fasting happens at the beginning of Passover, which makes her request even more shocking, because Passover is not a time for fasting. And she would have known that. And I think the shock of her request to Mordecai is intentional. She's intentionally saying, look, guys, this is a big deal. We've got to break every single custom we know of in order to focus on what really matters. Right? I don't think Now, the time she couldn't really manage, but her request in the time, she could. And the fact that she makes that request at that moment says she knew enough, at least, to know about fasting, and probably would have known that sleeping with someone who wasn't your husband is not the best idea, morally speaking, right? So, but ultimately we can't really answer that. But it is a good question, because that if we knew that, it would help us read this chapter a lot easier, for sure. So Esther, you know, good or bad, becomes the queen, and, you know, given what we know about the king, verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, is maybe the creepiest verse in the Bible. You know what I mean? Like, oh, man. Oh. Anyway, okay. That's my explanation of verse 17. You can quote me on that. Oh, man. Okay, but at the end of the chapter, another important event occurs, which is that Mordecai saves the king's life. Mordecai has been promoted in 2:11. You notice he's kind of like walking back and forth in front of the gate, in front of the harem. By the end of the chapter, he's sitting in the gate, which we learn in Ruth is a position of prominence and importance. He's been promoted. Now, maybe he's been promoted because of Esther's involvement. We don't really know, but that's not the point. The point is he's now in this position of some prominence, and in contrast to Esther, he doesn't hide his heritage, because in chapter 3, everybody in the gate knows he's Jewish, and in chapter 6, the king knows he's Jewish, because he actually recorded it in the Chronicles that Mordecai's the Jew saved the king's life, right? They know who he is. He's declared his heritage to them. And so he saves the king's life by recording this plot to assassinate him. What's more important about Mordecai than the specific actions is the pattern those actions fit into in the Old Testament. In Jeremiah 29, Jeremiah writes to the exiles in Babylon who were dealing with the difficulty of, or with the question of, do we kind of set up a new life for ourselves, or do we try to pretend like we're going home soon? And Jeremiah says, settle down, have children, build houses, plant vineyards, and Seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you, for in its welfare you will have welfare. Seek the peace, some translations say. It's the word shalom, but really it more means welfare than simply peace. In this story, the Persian government is portrayed as corrupt and foolish, and yet Esther and Mordecai work within that system to accomplish what they need to do. More than that, Mordecai actively suppresses attempts to overthrow that government, to assassinate this king who is such a drunk and loud, right? And so in a diaspora context where these people are wondering, does God still care about us, Esther demonstrates that Jeremiah's command still applies, and it demonstrates that God's people will still bless, that God will still bless his people if they obey him. And so Mordecai in this section is very commendable. We'll see some other things he does that are maybe not so commendable. But I want to say just a couple of things about assimilation, because it's something we talked about in Ruth. It's clearly a theme in Esther. Just kind of some lessons that we can learn from this story. The first one is that God's laws always supersede man's laws. That's what you obey. That's what Daniel and his friends did, both in the food and in the incident with the fiery furnace. They disobeyed the king to obey God, and because God's laws are superior. The second thing I would observe is that our willingness to assimilate unwisely, to do things like Esther seemingly does in this story, may be the most obvious demonstration to our of our commitment to God. Obvious meaning obvious, of course, to God, but even to those around us. What example are we setting as we are assimilating unwisely with the world around us? Now, what this assimilating wisely may involve a few things. And I've got some New Testament passages up here that I'm not going to go into, but you can look at them. They're basically just New Testament examples of these principles that I'm deriving from the book of Esther. Assimilating may involve a degree of social and political involvement in your community, which is condoned. It may involve carrying a label, like a Christian or Mordecai the Jew. It may involve compromising on things that don't actually matter spiritually. That it's not what I would prefer, but okay, I'm gonna do it because I'm seeking something. I'm more concerned about the things that are spiritual. And it may involve tolerating ungodly rulers and governments, and even, as Mordecai does, seeking their well-being, which might involve defending them when you don't think they're doing anything defensible. And it might involve voting when you feel like it's stupid and pointless. I don't know. You'll have to make those decisions on your own. But I do think the Bible demonstrates that this is part of what we are supposed to do as Christians. But it will always involve holding fast on morals and truth. And it will always involve using the influence and confidence that we gain by our assimilation in order to do God's work more effectively. That's very clear in the New Testament. So I hope this... and the last point, importantly for Esther, it's never too late to start unassimilating, which is what Esther does. And we'll see that in the coming chapters. Okay, thanks for your attention. Sorry we went a little bit long. Pick up in chapter 3 next time.
Right here, extra.
It is.
Okay, I'm going to take it.
If you need another one, I can make another one.
My husband said he has one. Okay. I just haven't.
Okay.
We have crossed paths with
such aware
of
that.
Okay.
So would unassimilating involve trying to separate from the king?
I don't know. I'm not going to answer that question.
It's a hard one.
Yeah, I think. And that's the thing, is like, so one commentator pointed out, no matter how you tell the story, Esther loses at the end. Because even if she doesn't, whether she remains the king's favorite or not, she's basically a widow. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of locked away for the rest of her life.